Pranam Swami. My name is Tushar. I have a question around the context, subjectiveness of I-ness.
It's on.
Every experience in our consciousness is, in addition to the I-amness, subjective to time and space, kala desha sapeksha. So isn't I-amness as well sapeksha to something, like to nothing, probably? So isn't that duality by itself?
Time and space also emerge in consciousness, in that I-amness. When I say I am, when the author is saying I am and I shine, basically, it means consciousness, you, the essential you or the real you. But time and space also emerge there. You know, the dream example shows that. So in our dreams, we are, it's like a virtual reality. It is a virtual reality. So you can see this person is here and that person is there, so there's space. And I talked with this person for some amount of time, I get a feeling of time passing. So the psychological sense of time and space is there in our dreams too. Although it's nothing but what the mind projects by itself. In consciousness, time and space also appear in consciousness. Time, space, causation. I've told this story earlier. The Vedanta is being taught in an ashram there. It's actual fact. And the Swami was saying that you're all pervading. And a monk at the back of the hall said, "Hey, wait a minute. I don't even pervade this hall. How can I be all pervading? I am here and you are there. I'm not all pervading, neither are you. You are here, Swami. You are there, Swami. And I am back there. How can I be all pervading? How can you be all pervading?" But it's obviously from the perspective of the body. And the answer from the teacher was very striking. He said, but here and there, are they not both within you? See, this is it's not a difficult point, but it's a little subtle. Isn't it within our consciousness that the sense of there and the sense of here, both are in consciousness? What I simply mean is, they are experienced by you. Another way of putting it is this. We get this sense that, No. The world is outside and I am experiencing the world. I am in the world. And that's also a body-centric way of looking at it. Here I am and clearly the world is outside my body. This is the limits of my body. Up to the tip of my fingers is the limits of my body. Just beyond that is other than my body. It's outside me. Whatever is in the body is inside me. But that's entirely body-centric. Switch to consciousness. Switch your perspective to consciousness. I am conscious of the body. I am conscious of the world. And the body is appearing in me, the consciousness. The world is equally appearing in me, the consciousness. The space in this world is equally appearing in me, the consciousness. The flow of time in this world is equally appearing in me, the consciousness. To make this easier, I can take another step. Mahakasha, Chittakasha, Chidakasha. Physical space, this vast universe. But in Vedanta, you have the concept of Chittakasha, the space of the mind. This is actually from Yoga Vashishta, mental space. And then you have the concept of consciousness space. Consciousness space just means consciousness. So all of physical space is enfolded in and appearing in the space of the mind. And the mind space is appearing in consciousness space. So physical space, time is experienced in the mind, and the mind is experienced in consciousness. It's an inside-out way of looking. Now, why am I saying this? A clear objection to this would be that, look, you are just arguing from your perspective, but you are just part of this vast universe, and you experience it in your own mind, that's true. That doesn't mean the universe is in your mind. There's a clear edge between you and the universe. Here's the edge, but the edge is a physical edge. This body ends here. And beyond this body is not this body. But where does consciousness end? When you say the universe is outside consciousness, where does consciousness end so that you can say inside consciousness and outside consciousness? Are you aware of an edge to consciousness? At this point, someone might ask a question. There is an edge. So, for example, I can see up to that, but I can't see beyond that building. So up to that building is the edge, and beyond that is beyond my consciousness. No, that's beyond your vision. It is within your consciousness as the seen, and beyond that the unseen. Both are in your consciousness. It's literally true. It's a more accurate description than we have of the physical way of looking at things. It's a strange way of looking at it, but it's more accurate. It's accurate in what sense? Phenomenologically accurate. Accurate to the way we experience life. This is a more accurate description of it. So if time and space appear in consciousness, then consciousness does not depend on time and space. Rather, time and space depends on consciousness, just like time and space in the dream depends on the dreaming mind. In that sense.
One follow-up question on that. The I am-ness itself, isn't it context of nothingness?
Oh, so I am, existence, isn't it the opposite of dependent on nothing? But no, it's not dependent on nothing, because nothing is nothing. There's nothing for it to be dependent on. Nothing. There is this whole nyaya. They have a whole investigation into nothing. The concept of abhava, absence. So in the Nyaya philosophy, absence is always dependent on something positive. They'll ask, absence of what and absence where? This is a clock. If I take it away, there's the absence of the clock. Where? Not everywhere in the universe, only on this table. The clock was on the table. Table is the location of the clock. Clock is the object. Now I remove the clock. You can clearly see the absence of the clock. Where? What is absent? Clock. Where is it absent? Table. So the absence, the negative, it always depends on the positive. The positive, however, does not depend on the negative. I remember I studied this at length once. There's this whole philosophy called Nyaya, and they have a further development called Navya Nyaya, neologic. And so a great pandit came to Calcutta, and he was teaching us this. Three courses, basic, intermediate, and advanced. And the advanced course was for 15 days, 5 hours a day, 15 days, and the subject was nothing. Nothing. And he would start every day. So for 15 days, 5 hours a day, we talked about nothing, literally. And it's a very sophisticated way of talking about nothing. So subtle. I mean, a tremendous analysis of what is nothing. And he would start, he had a stock example, which he would write painstakingly, the pandit would write on the blackboard. Bhutale ghato nasti. There is no pot on the surface, that means on the ground. And there's no pot on the ground. Or there's no pot on the table, just like the clock on the table. And then he would proceed to analyze this sentence. That's all we did for 15 days, 5 hours a day. And I still remember, this was in the Asiatic Society in Calcutta. Those who know Calcutta, they know it. The big hall. There was this caretaker of the hall, this gentleman who was supposed to, you know, clean up stuff, open it and lock it and all. He would listen to us. And then one day he approached me, because as a monk, I thought he felt more comfortable approaching me. The rest were all philosophers, or students, philosophy students. So he came to me and he said, you know, if you really want a pot, I could get it. It's there in the market. You guys have been cribbing about it for the last whole week, and there's no part going on and on about it. I could get one for you if you want. Yeah. So the absence of the part depends on the part, but the part itself doesn't depend on its absence. Yeah. Amritat, then we'll go to you next.
Thank you for everything and nothing. So I am shines, and we experience everything because of the shining of the I am. And when we sleep, deep sleep, we experience that nothingness, because we wake up and we're able to experience that there was something we call nothingness in sleep. When the body dies, or we die, when the body dies, the mind, right, the consciousness, when the electricity is turned off or whatever it is that keeps all this moving, how can we understand that consciousness does not also disappear and therefore couldn't be Brahman.
That's actually the next verse. Today we did verses 2 and 3. Verse 1 of this book is just a salutation to Guru and God. Very beautiful verse. Verse 2 is what we did. I am, I shine, and I am the object of continuous maximum love. It's Ananda, Satchit Ananda. The second verse was the universe. The next, third one was the universe appears in me like castles in the sky, the city of Gandharvas. The third verse considers the answer to Amitit's question. So you can see how, if you follow carefully the argument, the next question that pops up in your mind is the one he's going to answer. See, the question is this. You may give me all fancy arguments as much as you like, but I don't feel like that. I don't feel I'm infinite existence. I don't feel that I'm infinite consciousness. And certainly I don't feel I'm the fount of all joy and bliss. Quite the opposite. I feel that I am going to die. But then didn't we say... So I feel that I'm going to die. I don't feel that I am a Brahman. So suppose this is the argument. No matter what argument you give, I don't feel that I am Brahman. So I can't be Brahman. The answer to that is twofold. First of all, feeling is not a proof. You may feel whatever you like. So, if you feel that you are Brahman, that's also not a proof that you are Brahman. You could just be high, you know. I saw the news in New York City. They set up a dispenser for you know, where you can have weed and stuff like that. It all got sold out within minutes. So you could feel you're Brahman after smoking the Brahman pipe. That doesn't prove that you're Brahman. So that's one. Knowledge is what we're looking for. And knowledge comes from pramanas, the proof of knowledge or sources of knowledge. Feeling is not a source of knowledge. But still, is it possible to feel my knowledge and feeling to be in alignment? Yes, it is. We feel this way because we are solidly rooted in body consciousness. So from the perspective of the body, it's true. The body ages and dies. If you're literally the body, you're going to die. The question which comes in our mind is, it's all very fascinating, but you know, I have this intuitive feeling when the body dies, I could just as well be gone. What's behind that feeling? Behind the feeling is, first of all, the practical experience of, you can argue that I have no experience of my own death, but I am experiencing the death of so many people. So many people I know are dead or dying. And so I'm quite clear, even Vedanta teaches me, all religions teach me, that death is final, that everybody is going to die. Whoever is born, Gita Krishna says, whoever is born is fated to die. Jatasya hi dhruvo mrittu. But of course he follows up by saying dhruvam janma mritasya cha, and the certain is birth for those who are dead, which means you really didn't die. What happened was the body died. So when we say we have experienced so many people dying, so it's reasonable to assume that I will die. What we have experienced is the death of the body, and that's what we have been arguing all along. You, the consciousness, are not literally the body. Even if the body dies, it could well be that I will be there to experience the death of the body. And I am not the body. Just as, and again I'm repeating from the Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, just as you experience from babyhood to childhood, the body changed so much. From childhood to teenage, the body changed so much. From teenage to middle age to old age, the body changes dramatically. And yet you say, I am the same one. Similarly, one more dramatic change is coming, death of the body. And you will still say, I am the same one. When we understand clearly the difference between the body and I, the experiencing consciousness, then I will not think that the death of the body could be my death. Just as these are objects, they are acting and interacting with each other, I am the experiencer. So this body is also an object in my experience. If this body stops, dies, it's quite possible that I'll still continue to be conscious, I'll still be a conscious self, that I am will continue, maybe in some other body. That's the whole idea of reincarnation. Now the deeper question there, a philosophical question behind what Amitit asked is, somewhere we are convinced that I, the consciousness, am being generated by physical processes, by the brain,
by the neurology and the brain, that's generating me. Clearly, at death, the brain dies. And the nervous system is dead. And therefore, consciousness won't be there anymore. So the dream example doesn't hold true, because one could argue, yes, you may not be aware of your body in the dreams and you still continue to be a conscious being in your dreams, but your body is still there. It's a living body and the brain is still functioning and generating you the consciousness and your dream also. So the foundation for your consciousness is still there. But if you destroy the body, there will be no waking, dreaming, deep sleep, nothing. It's just gone, zero, finished. So this is called the materialist, reductionist view of consciousness. And this sort of mainstream idea, the only catch here, you know, the hard problem of consciousness. Yeah. David Chalmers, who coined the term, the hard problem of consciousness, is right here in NYU. In fact, next week, I strongly recommend it. On Friday next week, they're going to have this conference at NYU. 25 years of consciousness studies. And so David Chalmers is there, Christoph Koch, and a number of other philosophers and scientists are there. So the hard problem of consciousness. First, prove that consciousness can be reduced to the brain. There's simply no proof at all. The answer to that is what is called promissory materialism. That give us time, we'll prove it. Consciousness is nothing but the brain, but 25, 30, 40, 50 years, and then we'll prove it. We are advancing. No, the hard problem of consciousness is a problem in principle. It's not a technical problem. It's not that when you have more technology, more advancement in neuroscience, then you will show that consciousness is generating from the brain. How can a physical process, an objective process, give rise to the subject? Let me put it in this. This can put it in different ways. Let me put it in this way. All of these things, material objects, they have only one nature, what they are as it is. They're physical entities and they have properties. You can investigate them. They have only one thing. They're the physical side of it. Now you are saying there is one unique thing in the universe, your brain, which has two sides to it. One is the physical side, the matter, the cells, the neurons, and all of that is the physical side, the electrical activity, the physical side, and an internal subjective side. We are claiming that. Why should this particular organ have that? You see the force of the argument. Why should only one entity in the entire universe have this dual nature, objective and... Brain is clearly objective. It's a piece of living flesh. And when it dies, it will die. It will be dead organic matter. But that's what it only should be. Why should it have an internal... All of us here have an internal feeling. I am aware. And I am seeing and hearing. I am thinking. I am feeling. I have a sense of time and space, a personhood. Where is that coming from? Why does this not have it? There is no answer. Literally no answer. How is tiny electrical activity in the brain generating mind and consciousness? Nobody knows. Ask the cutting-edge neuroscientists, philosophers of mind. Nobody knows. Another argument, I'll give a third argument and stop there, that to show that this brain is not generating consciousness, is this. Nowadays, it's a unique argument. I don't know if I came up with it, but I haven't heard anybody else making it. It's that the recent advances in AI. So right now, you have things like ChatGPT and other advanced AI, which is going to get even more advanced. There's some computer scientists told me that they're looking for exponential growth of AI. Now they can do everything that we can do. This AI, it has intelligence, it has creativity, it can paint pictures, write stories, it's already doing that. I asked it to write poems on Swami Vivekananda, it did a better job than I could ever do. Not only that, I asked it to write another poem, and it did another great poem on Vivekananda. And if I ask it every time, every few seconds it will generate a poem throughout the day and throughout the month, it will generate thousands of poems, and pretty good poems. And they may not be masterpieces, but they are better than anything, say, a school kid could come up with or a college kid. So creativity. They're already winning competitions in painting, in short story writing. First prize. And then they found it was not written by a human being. It's written by a machine, by a computer. Now, intelligence, creativity, which we thought was human. Now machines do it. Except one thing. Machines have intelligence, creativity, memory, decision-making capacities. They can drive a car, they can paint a picture, write a story, except one thing. They can't do one thing. You know what that one thing is? They have no sense of I am. They have no sense of consciousness. There's no there's nothing in there. Right there, in that head, there's a light burning. Lights are on there. You're not zombies. In a computer, there is no consciousness there. You say, how do you know? You're not a computer scientist. Yes, ask the computer scientist. Ask the experts. Have you programmed the AI for consciousness? They'll say, no. We don't even know what consciousness is. We don't know how to begin programming something for consciousness. We can program. See, my argument here is this. My argument is, actually, intelligence is a complex thing. It's difficult, complex. Creativity, very complex. To genuinely simulate creativity is very complex, difficult. And the computer scientists are now able to do these complex things in machines. In comparison to that, consciousness is very simple. What does consciousness do? There's only one thing. It gives you experience. It shines and gives you experience. All sorts of experiences, but all sorts of experiences depend on the objects. If there's a form, you have experience of seeing. If there's a sound, you have experience of hearing. If there's a thought, you have experience of thinking. But experience is what consciousness does. Simple, first-person experience. It should have been simple enough to program it. And yet it isn't. There is no grasp, even no traction on the problem. What is consciousness, let alone how do we program it into machines? The Vedantic conclusion tallies very well with the hard problem of consciousness. You cannot reduce consciousness to the brain. If you cannot, then you cannot claim that the brain generates consciousness. It definitely is connected with mind. There's a hard, there is a strong correlation. That's what Chalmers calls the easy problems of consciousness, the correlation between neuronal activity and a reported subjective experience. There's some kind of deep connection there, but you can't say connection means causality, that it's producing consciousness. This is where it stuck, the whole consciousness studies field. It's the most important question in science today. I saw a list, the most important unsolved question in science. Second question was hard problem of consciousness. I think it's the first question. It should be the first question. Most important. All right, thank you.
Is there a translation of the sutras you're reading that we can
yes.
get?
Yes. So there is a book. There are two, to my knowledge, there are two English translations. The older one by Swami Tejomayananda of the Chinmay Mission, and the latest one, Advaita Makaranda, The Nectar of Non-Duality by Swami Atmarupananda, published by Advaita Ashram, I think. It's an inexpensive little book. It's easily available. The lady there, yes. Tell us your name and ask the question.
Namaskar, I'm Swami. I'm Anita, O's wife. I have a questions of three, like always. We are into bhakti, like ISKCON. So according to Bhagavad Gita, there is Karno Dakshaya Vishnu, who pervading the whole universe, and Garbho Dakshaya Vishnu, and Kshiro Dakshaya Vishnu. And one more question is, consciousness is only through realization. When we get the realization, we can know the consciousness. That is the second one. What I mean, one body, single body, we have so many of, do we have one soul, so many of bacteria present in us? So can we tell, Karno Dakshaya is whole, we are pervading, Aham Brahmasmi?
Yeah.
So,
my advice to you would be not to mix up the two approaches. One is a bhakti approach. One is a jnana approach. If you mix them up, the results will be devastating. Yeah. So, for example, let me give a small example. Do you realize this consciousness? Only when we realize it, then we know this consciousness. But we know this consciousness. How would you know anything? Only through consciousness. Right now you are knowing, right? You're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. How is that possible? See, the Advaita approach is, you have to see, it's dramatically different from anything else. Dramatically different. It's not believing in a text, believing in some kind of extra cosmic God. And so the bhakti approach begins with belief and faith and continues for a while, at least, until you get, by the grace of God, you get a mystical experience or something. It continues on the basis of faith. This is not on the basis of faith. This is on the basis of your current experience. At which point did I talk about Vishnu swimming in an ocean of milk or lying down, floating in an ocean of milk? Nowhere. At which point did I talk about you will do some sadhana, then you'll realize something and then you will know consciousness? Even the statement, I will know consciousness, shows a complete lack of understanding of what consciousness is. Question would be, forget all the spiritual stuff. Do you know anything now? Yeah. I am seeing, hearing. You say, I know, I am Anita. How do you know all that? What is it that is knowing anything right now? Just go back to first principles, our experience of life itself now. That's the Advaita approach. Advaita approach is, it's like that washerman who had a stone, you know, and it was a diamond. He didn't know it was a diamond. And he went on scrubbing clothes with it until somebody told him it's a diamond and, you know, if you sell it, you get lots of money and all your wants will be removed forever. We have the diamond. We think it's a stone and we are scrubbing dirty laundry with it. What's the diamond? Consciousness itself. And what are we doing with it? We see, hear, smell, taste, touch. We love, we hate, we go through life, we suffer. Even suffering is because of consciousness. And we do spiritual practices. We do bhakti, yoga, jnana, all of these. All of these are possible only because of consciousness. If you're not consciousness, if you see God. But seeing God requires you to be conscious first. So it's a dramatically different approach. To understand this approach based on the Bhagavad Gita, you would have to read Shankara's commentaries on Bhagavad Gita. But you don't have to. You can take the bhakti approach and hold on to that. That will also take you to this. Sri Ramakrishna's beauty was that, you know. He said, through the bhakti approach, through the meditative approach, through the jnana approach, in every religion, you can reach that highest. All right. Yeah.
Actually, Aham Brahmasmi, like Shankaracharya, he presented at a time, he presented 8 places. And the same way, Krishna presented 14,000, 16,000 places with all Gopikas. So how can we think that we are God, Aham Brahmasmi? That's the main question always I get.
Never think that you are God.
Brahman.
Brahman here is not God.
Okay.
Brahman here is limitless consciousness. You are that which appears as Anita and Anita's God also. That consciousness. And the beauty of Shankaracharya is, the beauty of Advaita Vedanta is, to that question, the reply will be, forget Shankaracharya, forget Krishna, forget anybody who ever lived. Look at your own experience right now. See, our minds are loaded with a huge amount of the past, the burden of the past. And massive amounts of beliefs and ideas and concepts. Advaita Vedanta says, all of that is possible because of what? Look at your own experience. Not even answer. If I ask, what are you? You can say that I am a jiva. But that's just a concept. All concepts, all experiences are grounded in you, the consciousness. What is that? So, think about that. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Who else wants to come up here? There's somebody at the right at the back. I'll come to you later. Right at the back, please come up here and ask the question. Come up here and ask the question. Tell us your name and ask the question.
Sandhya, I just wanted to know if there is an ethical argument that Advaita has against, not against, but about artificial intelligence and the work that has been. I know that science is something that we support, but trying to figure out what consciousness is and trying to program, where do human beings stand in our own search for finding, figuring out who we are, and then there's this whole world that's being created, which, you know, you see these science fiction movies and they show you these things taking over our world. So,
yeah. So is there an ethical argument against AI? I don't know really, because this AI thing is new, right? Artificial intelligence is new. And many people are worried. I just heard recently the person behind ChatGPT, Sam Altman, he's very worried. And he gave strong warnings in Congress last week. It was before a congressional committee, and he said that we should be very careful. He's the one behind this technology, but he said we should be very careful across the world and put guidelines and restrictions into place. Of course, there's an economic reason. Lots of people are going to lose jobs, huge economic dislocation, all of that. That's a big problem. But there's a deep psychological problem, which he has pointed out. And I think that's worth considering, quite apart from spirituality, religion. If, you see, AI threatens our very idea of who we are. A car doesn't do that. You don't want to compete against a car. You know, I can run faster than the car. No, you don't want. I can't even run faster than, say, a dog. So I know it's okay that I have some physical limitations. A machine like a car can go much faster. A crane can lift much more weight than I can. Physically, I have no problem with machines being better than me. It's okay, and they'll help me. To some extent, it was okay. You know, we got a little scared when Deep Blue defeated Grandmasters, and we have people here who program Deep Blue and also. We got a little scared because these machines are more intelligent than our most intelligent human beings, you know. But now we have machines, and not only machines, there's not some powerful computer somewhere in a lab. It's available to everybody all the time. And they do many things which you are doing, and they will keep on doing, increasing the capacity to everything that we are doing, especially at the more subtle levels. Literature, poetry. Uh-huh. We all thought that the age of machines will come, and then it'll just give more leisure to us so that we'll be freed of all the drudgery and we can do the wonderful things which only we human beings can do. You know, art, literature, poetry, and no, the machines jumped ahead of us. They started doing that stuff. And next they'll say, you do the drudgery. It reminds me of, what are we there to do? We are there to program the machines. That reminds me of old Reader's Digest joke, when the first rockets were going into space. So they sent up dogs and chimps into space. So they sent up a joint team of, it's a joke, of an astronaut and a chimpanzee. And all from NASA, Houston, all the time, instructions. So Houston to, you know, spacecraft, to the chimp. Do this, do that, and the chimpanzee is doing everything. The human being begins to feel useless, you know. Finally, a command comes from NASA to the human astronaut. And the astronaut, at last, yeah, tell me, what do I do? Feed the chimp. Now, that's the level we are coming to. Feed. Yes, a PhD in literature from a top university in the world told me that the job they can look forward to is teaching English to AI. And the other things AI will do. So that threatens our very sense of, psychological sense of who we are. That could be a very serious danger.
Yeah. But my question was in terms of religion, in terms of following the path of realizing God.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's as human beings that we can find enlightenment or otherwise. But this whole, I'm not clear in my question completely. Okay. I'm not going to ask.
Nobody's clear. Don't worry. Nobody's clear. We are all trying to reformulate.
Like,
all
right, what's the argument for
next
religion?
The lady there who had raised her hand, please come on up here. And then we'll come to you next. Tell us your name and ask the question.
Yes, my name is Emily. And my question is, why is this isness bliss? Satchit Ananda, if Ananda is beyond a feeling of, yeah, like happiness, why do we name it as such? Yeah.
So this is a question many people ask, and many people say that you talk about existence, you talk about isness, you talk about consciousness, the shining, but you don't talk much about the bliss aspect of it, Ananda aspect of it. I have on occasion. But let me explain here. The moment we say ananda, bliss, what comes to our mind? A feeling, a nice feeling, maybe the nicest feeling. And then when you next say that it's not a feeling, then why are you calling it bliss? But think, exactly the same thing is true of existence and consciousness. when we think of existence, what do we think of? We think of existing things. Table, human being, even space is an existing thing, existing entity. We don't think of existing itself, existence itself. Existence itself is not an existing thing. Even the I am is not an existing thing. Then when you say I am and you think it's an existing thing, an entity, then you're thinking about the ego. That's what Vivekananda meant when he said, it's not something that exists, it's existence itself. The example, which good example is gold and ornaments. So you have bracelets and rings and tiaras and whatnot. And then somebody comes and tells you, the reality of all of these is gold. Now, if you start looking for one more ornament called gold, you'll never find it. If you think, all right, there is necklace and tiara and bracelets, and now I'm being told the real thing is gold. So which is the one? Let me look through the catalog of ornaments. Will I find gold anywhere? Nowhere. And then if you come to the conclusion, gold doesn't exist then. You'd be entirely wrong. In fact, it's just the other way around. It is gold that exists. The ornaments, bracelet, tiara, necklace, they are names and forms imposed upon gold. Exactly like that. Consciousness. When we say consciousness, what comes to mind? Thoughts, feelings, emotions. In fact, when you go to consciousness studies, what do they study? If you ask a consciousness studies expert, a philosophy of mind expert, they do not distinguish between mind and consciousness. They say, oh, we study thoughts and emotions and, you know, pain and pleasure and memory, and all of this is consciousness studies. No, no, no. These are all powered by consciousness. They're lit up by you, the consciousness, and then you experience thoughts, feelings, emotions, and ideas. But each conscious experience is not consciousness itself. No more than a golden ornament is gold by itself. The reality is gold, but then it has been given a particular name and form. Similarly, the reality is consciousness, and it's been given a particular experience of thinking or pleasure or pain. Consciousness continues. Similarly, now we have to understand ananda. Ananda by itself is not a particular feeling. It is that when reflected in the mind gives us the feeling of joy. See, in our life, we exist, we think, we have conscious experiences, but we also, we look for meaning, purpose, fulfillment, beauty, joy, pleasure. And what we are looking for is ananda. Just as existing things depend on sat, pure existence. All conscious experiences depend on chit, pure consciousness. All pleasurable feelings, all happiness, all kinds of bliss and joy, they depend on ananda. One example I'll give you that will make it clear. When I look at my face in the, when you look at your face in the mirror, you see your face reflected in the mirror. But the reflected face is not your real face. Your real face could be reflected in 100 mirrors, you would see 100 different faces, 100 different reflections of the same face. A better mirror will give you a better reflection. You see it in a pool of muddy water, it'll give you a vague reflection. See it in a pool of clear water, it'll give you a clearer reflection. See it in a mirror, dirty mirror, one reflection. Polished mirror, one reflection. In a titanium polished mirror, the best reflection. They are all reflections of one reality. Right? When you are seeing your face in the mirror, you're seeing a reflection of your face. You're not actually seeing your face directly. The advantage of the reflection is it can be seen. But the problem with the reflection is it's not real. It's not really your face. And now notice the connection between the reflection and your real face. The reflected face depends on your real face. Unless the face is there, unless a mirror is there, there will be no reflection. But your real face does not depend on the reflection. Take away the mirror, take away the reflection, you can't see it anymore. Doesn't mean that your face is gone. None of us are anxious, mirror anxiety. If I lose my mirror, what will happen? I'm gone. No. I can see myself in one mirror, I can see myself in 100 mirrors, I'm still the same. Now, the bliss, the happiness that we experience in life, worldly happiness, even spiritual happiness. Upanishad talks about the three kinds. The, you know, what Sri Ramakrishna used to call Vishayananda, Bhajanananda, Brahmananda. The Vishayananda is your nature as Ananda reflected in the pleasures of the world. Bhajanananda is the your nature reflected in spiritual life, in meditation, prayer, devotion. There's a great joy in bhakti. That is Bhajanananda. And that will be there the more spiritual we are. But what is being reflected in all of that, that itself is Ananda.
Instead
yes, you can call it meaning. You can call it meaning, purpose, beauty, joy, pleasure, all of that. Think about it. The three great questions in philosophy. What is real? Metaphysics. Nowadays a fancy name is there, ontology. What's real? Second, how do we know anything? Epistemology. And third, what is good? What is beautiful? Earlier there were many subjects, ethics, then aesthetics and so on. Now they have all combined under axiology, which is basically meaning or purpose, a fulfillment. And the answer to these three, I was just thinking, Sat, Chit, Ananda, what is real? Sat. The solution to all of metaphysics is the answer from Vedanta is Sat. The solution to all epistemology, the answer from Vedanta is Chit, consciousness, which makes knowledge possible. And the solution to the questions of axiology, ethics and aesthetics is Ananda. What is the point of it all? How will I reach complete fulfillment? Well, that is Ananda. Oh, how do I get it? It's you. You are reflected in every little fulfillment in your life. And that those little fulfillments, when they are frustrated, that is what is pain. Short answer, you are Ananda. The more you explore that I am-ness, you will find whatever we are seeking in the world outside is actually there. That's what it is. We go around the world with a begging bowl. Give us a little happiness, little recognition, little praise, little success. That's what we are trying to do. But we don't need it. Whatever the world can give us back is like the mirror reflecting your face. We want as many reflections as possible. That's being rich, being popular, being... So whatever way we seek happiness in the world, it's just more and more reflections we want. But you don't need any of those reflections. Those reflections need you. Without you, no reflection is possible. Those reflections are the worldly or even religious joys. And you are Ananda itself.
Buddhists are saying the same thing in saying that it doesn't have like, I'm not super familiar, but in saying that it's not a positive or a negative connotation to yes. bliss, it's just yes. everywhere, so it might as well be...
A misunderstanding of Buddhism would be the negative, that they're saying nothing is there.
Right.
A misunderstanding of Vedanta would be positive, they're saying something is there.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah. Mm. So both something and nothing, they depend upon that reality itself. Just as the presence of a reflection and the absence of the reflection make no difference to you, the original face. But you make all of that possible.
Yeah. Thank you.
The presence of the reflection does not mean you are that. And the absence of the reflection does not mean you are gone. No. Right.
Thank you.
The lady there, she was asking a question. And we'll end with you. Yeah. Tell us your name and ask the question.
Yeah, my name is Payal. So one thing that creates this separate feeling is that this body and this mind appears in my consciousness and other bodies and other minds don't appear in my consciousness.
No, they do. Through this body and mind, all of them, we're all here, right?
But hello. I'm not experiencing their sensory world. Their sensory perception.
Yes, you're not experiencing their sense. You are experiencing through this body mind.
Yeah, so I was wondering how to address this separateness that other sensory yes. worlds are not correct. Appearing in my consciousness.
Correct. So what you're asking is that I am consciousness and everything is in me true, but I am experiencing everything through one body mind. And I see everything from this perspective and my knowledge is also very limited in this mind, whatever is there in this mind. I may be the one consciousness in all bodies and mind, but I don't experience myself that way. When I say, I don't experience myself that way, who is that I? That's Payal. Already you are channeled through this Payal body-mind, personality. Now, if you're saying that, how can I experience myself as all other beings? Then answer is directly that you are. As consciousness, you are shining through all beings. But see, this question is asked by the mind, the Payal's mind. I know the contents of my own mind, and I can have the sensory experiences through my own body. Why can't I know the contents of everybody's mind and have sensory experiences through everybody's body? Is that possible at all? It's possible for God, what is called Virat or Hiranyagarbha, the cosmic mind, who's connected to all of us and sees and experiences through all of us. Ishwara, for Bhagavan, not for individual jiva. Is another way of explaining this is ocean and wave. The wave can never be the ocean. All waves are part of the ocean. Ocean is like Ishwara and waves are like individual beings. But what is Advaita saying? Advaita is saying both wave and ocean depend on water. You are water. Now, as water, you are this wave, that wave, everything, and the entire ocean also. Also, one little clarification. All these examples are limited. The moment I say water, what will happen in our minds is, okay, I'm water, I understand the difference between wave, ocean, and water. But waves have little water, and ocean has lots of water. So I'm still little. I'm only a little bit of water. No, there's no little or lots in Advaita. It's not part and whole relationship. If you have a part and whole relationship, it's called Vishishta Advaita. Yeah. It is absolute identity. You are all of it. And even all is a concession to language. Think about it as wave, ocean. Why the wave cannot be the ocean? Because as long as I'm limited in the wave form, I will know only myself. But all Advaita wants you to realize is that you are water itself. The wave form will come and go. All waves will arise and pass away. But water doesn't pass away. Which is more powerful, wave or ocean? Which is greater? You're scared. Ocean. Yes, ocean. But which is greater, wave, ocean, or water? Water. Why? Because if you take the water out of the ocean, even ocean won't exist. But water can exist. Water can exist as water vapor. It can exist as water in your glass. Ocean depends on water. Wave depends on water. But water doesn't depend on ocean or water. So that is pure consciousness, Satchidananda. That appears as Ishwara or Bhagavan and as all of us, as jivas. Advaita never says that jiva is Bhagavan, that ordinary person is God. No. Never. That's wrong. But what Advaita wants to say is that jiva is also Brahman and Ishwara or Bhagavan is also Brahman. There you are one. All right, we'll end with you. Come. Yes. I think you've been raising your hand for a long time, so we'll end with you. All right, come.
Maharaj, I'm Shri. So, consciousness is neither born nor dies, and the Jnani internalizes this clearly, and with that knowledge, the Jnani is transcending suffering.
Yes.
So I have to ask about grief, because we are not our feelings, yes. But grief feels very organic, yes. And grief is blindsiding. Arjuna was blindsided by grief for his son.
Yes.
Thakur at least exhibits grief, who is the truth. Oh. So that makes one wonder, you know, here we are, trying to transcend grief, but I don't know, yes. Arjuna couldn't transcend grief. Tried.
But Krishna could. Ramakrishna could. Mm-hmm. So what it does is this. Once you realize you are this ever-present I am-ness, the experience of the world doesn't cease. So if I like a cookie and I eat it and it tastes nice, then I realize I am consciousness. That's a fact. And then through the mind and the tongue, I'm experiencing the sweetness of the cookie. Will the cookie now no longer taste sweet because I am consciousness? No. The world will be experienced exactly as it is. Pleasure will be experienced exactly as it is. But you know that you are not this one individual being chasing that particular pleasure. Both are made possible because you are consciousness. Grief, pain will be exactly as it is. Sri Ramakrishna's example of dying, he's dying of cancer, and yet he says, Hari Maharaj said, I see that you're in great bliss. And Sri Ramakrishna's answer was that, the rascal has found me out. Now, is he not feeling the pain of the cancerous sore? He is. Advaita is not escapism. Advaita is transcending the pain. So, grief. Now, would an enlightened person feel grief? Yes. When Swami Vivekananda heard that his sister had committed suicide, he wept. And then somebody said, Swami, you're weeping. He said, I don't want to be a hard-hearted sannyasi like that. Can you feel the grief? Can you feel suffering? He felt more than most of us. He felt the sufferings of humanity. He had the greatest heart. In fact, there's a song, Jaya Jaya Ramakrishna Bhuvana Mangala. So it was composed by Swami Premeshanandaji. And there you find the names of Sri Ramakrishna, Ma Sharada, Vivekananda, and all the direct disciples and some of the householder disciples also. And there's an epithet for each of them. Just one word for each of them. For Vivekananda, he wrote, Swami Premeshanandaji, Jaya Vivekananda Paramadayala. Glory to Vivekananda, victory to Vivekananda, who is most compassionate. So, Swami told me that he asked Swami Premeshanda, because we think of Vivekananda as this tremendous intellect, great yogi, great dynamic worker. Why did you write most compassionate? And the Swami said, as you go through life, you'll understand. The greatest thing about Vivekananda was his heart. His intellect, his dynamism, his eloquence, his strength, his, all of that is great, but the greatest thing was his heart. Now, he experienced that suffering. But then what? How is he different from the rest of us? He is able to transcend. Like Sri Ramakrishna, he knows the body, he knows the pain of the body, but he also knows as Atman, as pure consciousness, is beyond this pain. It's that Atman, that consciousness itself, which makes pain possible. But consciousness itself has no pain in itself. From that perspective, there's no pain. So grief, will one experience grief? Yes. As much as anybody else. And yet, can one transcend it? Yes. Transcending, that's the word transcending. Transcending being there and yet not of it. Being in the boat, but you're not, the boat is in water, but water is not in the boat. So, you're in the midst of the world, experiencing the world, including its pains. Everything as everybody else experiences, but you see a higher reality beyond that, which is you yourself. There it's all right. Yeah, that's what happens. That's transcending.
Thank you.
Yes. Bill, do you still remember your question? Okay. Do you have a question? Yeah. We'll end with that.
Amritamshu, you had mentioned that when you pursuing the path of bhakti, you'll come into problems when you also try and relate it to Advaita. But when I think of Ramakrishna or other avatars, I see embodiments of all those paths. And I think you had just said that, you know, don't, that the individual self is not unlimited consciousness, but we actually gather our faith and our learning from these great examples.
Yes.
So my question is there not a synthesis of
right.
these paths?
You're right. Absolutely right. You see Sri Ramakrishna, Shankaracharya and others who are great gyanis, but they have deep devotion. Even Ramana Maharshi, you see sometimes deep devotion to Arunachal and all. So there's no conflict between jnana and bhakti and yoga and karma. In reality, what I was mentioning is a very particular problem. What I was saying is that particular problem means it is understood among Advaitins, non-dualists, that on the path of jnana, on the path of devotion, for beginners, for most of us, bhakti is very useful. With the foundation of bhakti, one is... If you are in the path of bhakti, for a beginner again, jnana need not be... I mean, you don't have to dabble in jnana. Bhakti enough is enough by itself. Bhakti will take you towards God realization. And then you will see later on what everybody is doing is also what I am doing. That's fine. Sometimes the jnana approach at the beginning can be damaging to bhakti. That's why in the bhakti schools, you will find a warning against the jnana approach. If I'm starting on faith, and I'm also trying to question it at the very beginning, it won't work. You'll damage your bhakti. So Ramakrishna was very careful about his young disciples. He used to use the word bhav nashto kortini. Bhava means you're building up a spiritual attitude towards God. Don't damage it. Don't destroy it at the beginning. He used to say, put a fence around it. Once, he says, the sapling grows into a big banyan tree, you can tie an elephant to it also. No problem. It'll be fine. So initially at the stage of beginning, when most of us are there, it's good to cultivate one particular attitude. However, in our lineage, we cultivate, as you said, all of them. On the basis of jnana, you can cultivate yoga and bhakti and karma. Sri Ramakrishna would say that tie the knowledge of Advaita to your, he would say, the typical thing you see in India, women tying keys to the hem of their cloth, bunch of keys they tie. He would say, tie the knowledge of Advaita to the hem of your cloth and then do whatever else you like. Whatever else you like means, if you want to be a bhakta, be a bhakta. If you want to be a dynamic worker for the welfare of the world, be a karmi, karma yogi. If you want to retreat into meditation and be centered in the Atman, na kinchidapi chintayet, Krishna says that center your mind in your nature as pure consciousness and then don't think anymore. You can do that also. Yeah. All of that is possible. But yeah, you're right. In truth, in reality, there is no conflict between them. Very good. Let me do a peace chant. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Shri Ram Krishna Rupanamastu.